Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 51, where we are discussing a journal article by Harry Tsoukas called The Tyranny of Light, published in 1997. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Riga in Latvia.
And this is Tom, calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Ella, coming to you from a very sunny Münster in Germany.
Lovely. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
So, another exciting episode, this time discussing a work by someone who has been on the podcast previously and someone who is a good friend of ours, Harry Tsoukas. I'm particularly quite keen on this one because it's all about knowledge and information and the different aspects of it.
Absolutely. This is a favorite paper of mine, which I've seen in other papers as well. I've seen these ideas reflected over time. So I'm really looking forward to discussing it.
Indeed, I am as well. But it's also interesting because rather than a long book, it's a nice short article, but that doesn't mean it was light reading.
Well, let's get to it. Who would like to give an introduction to this work?
I would love to. So, okay, the article was published in a journal called Futures back in 1997. And what it does is it was a looking forward, if you will, at the growing information society. And at the time, there was a lot of optimism about how more information or the ability to access and to become contributors to an information society could make things more transparent, help. It was just a lot of good things were going to come from it. Now, what Harry was doing in this was basically providing somewhat of a warning, saying that, there's a lot that will happen as information societies grow and information becomes more available, but there's kind of a dark side to it, and the dark side is sort of riddled with, or is shaped by several of what he calls paradoxes, and he presents opening up with the idea that in an information society, what happens to information, how it's encoded, how it's created, how it's used, becomes increasingly more objectified. And in the process of doing so, several paradoxes, which he lists as more information would result in less understanding, more information could result in more misuse or less trust in the information, and so he's trying to issue a warning that, you know, just because we have this information society doesn't mean that utopia is on its way. And so I think one of the things that that makes this kind of fun for me as I was reading it is, all right, so here we are 20 plus years after he published it. And to what extent is what he warned about, how much of it came to fruition, how has things changed since he wrote it? You know, a lot of these things we could perhaps dissect in the course of our dialogue.
Yeah, I think it is a prophetic paper in many ways. And essentially, at the beginning of it, Harry gives almost a dichotomy of potential futures. One is this more utopian, where information society leads to a wiser society. So kind of hinting almost at the notion of information leading to knowledge, leading to wisdom, where we're able to make better decisions and discern more insight from the information. And on the other hand, he gives this picture of a future where big data essentially allows automated decision-making and pattern recognition in the workplace and in societies, and where, because of this, less value is placed on insight and more value is placed on correlation and patterns. And so machines take precedent over people, and it's a bit of a dystopian kind of a hint there that machines and algorithms put individuals out of work or de-skill the work or devalue the work or things like that. So in light of kind of our episodes on the gig economy and on the digital economy, this is a very interesting reading to go back to.
Absolutely. And I really like that Tsoukas is going back to considering, well, probably because it was from 1997, but is considering the role that information plays here and how technology has also led to this distance between an event and how it is then interpreted, and then through that interpretation, actions are made. So, for example, he speaks about what Thompson calls despatialized simultaneity. So it's possible to experience events as simultaneous without being close to where they happen. And it's this sense of distance that really was quite revolutionary during the time when people were talking about the information society, because you could learn about an event on the other side of the world instantly. And so this led to a sort of decontextualization of information that had not been possible before communication technologies had sped up the transmission of this information. But then he's really interrogating the assumptions that come with that, which include that it is possible to understand a distant event, to understand occurrences that you didn't experience yourself via information that you then read or see displayed in a dashboard, for example. And that thinking is still so prominent, as you're saying to me, she's in these assumptions that we can manage Uber workers, for example, using algorithmic technologies. People don't need to be close to the action to act upon people and systems. And that's problematic, as Tsoukas highlights in these various different ways.
Right before he talks about despatialized simultaneity, he draws a comparison, a very interesting comparison, with the printing press. And the printing press as a metaphor of rapid changes in communication means affecting society is, I mean, it's a very commonly used metaphor. I think it was a bit of a new use of that metaphor at the time. That back in history, we have seen this before, where a new means of technology is available, which causes a new ability to spread information, which in this case was basically the Gutenberg Bible. And then from that spread of information, all of these other societal changes occurred. He doesn't go into a lot of detail, but yeah, I mean, basically the Gutenberg Bible touched off what became the Protestant Revolution, and then, you know, a whole bunch of social upheaval followed. And so I think it was interesting for him to set that as sort of like a historical context. Are we in 1997, that is, about to embark on the same kind of a journey, the same kind of a revolutionary journey in which the information technology is going to create social change that we don't necessarily see, or that what we think is going to happen is possibly not going to happen and these other things are going to happen instead?
Right, I think one thing there is also that it's not just the information that is a catalyst to this, right? So he talks about and cites, I think, Giddens when speaking of mediums, right? Because the information itself, at least for Tsoukas, does not translate into knowledge. It is the adoption and use of the medium by which this information is carried that results in an application of knowledge. So for the Gutenberg Bible, if people were not able to consume information in that form, that would not lead to anything, right? Hence his fork in the road in 97 about where we're going. What will be the medium that will carry the information in the future, and what will be the consequences of individuals using that medium? Are we going to go down the route of automation, or are we going to go down the route of... I don't know, we didn't quite go there, but some form of discerning value from the more widely available information, like kind of the promise of the internet initially.
Well, the way in which he introduced that passage too is also important. It's the dissolution of centralized perspectives, because the other thing that the Gutenberg Bible did was it really upset the structures of how information was controlled, which really was a big part of how... This new means created conditions of social change, that those who, because the Bible was not widely available. As a matter of fact, it was pretty much held in reserve by the church. And so then the ability for the information to be out there meant that those who were in control of the old information lost that control, and that contributed to the level of upheaval.
I think that's what everyone was so optimistic about, this idea that we could decentralize our media, that information would be available to everyone. And parallel to that way of thinking is this ideal of transparency, which is what Tsoukas is problematizing here. The ideal that if we can just shed more light on what is actually going on what is real, on the real world, then we will be better equipped to act on it. And that sort of has gotten caught up with, okay, we need an internet where everyone can access information and everything's open. And yet we don't seem to be getting any better at dealing with social problems. And in fact, the attempt to try and bring everything into the light so that you can really inspect it and make it accountable can actually have perverse effects and can undermine the good aspects of what it is that you're trying to manage. How did you both react to this whole metaphor of transparency and how Tsoukas is dealing with it here? Because it's sort of a theme that he starts with a poem about shedding light on things that were previously hidden and whether that's something that we actually are prepared for, hence the title of The Tyranny of Light, and which I really like this sort of playful way of thinking about, is transparency all it's cracked up to be? But I'm curious about your impressions on that theme.
I think one of the challenges that I suppose will probably come out as we get into the particular paradoxes that he includes in the latter half is that there perhaps was an assumption in the utopian view that greater transparency of the information is not going to change the information. And if it was just a matter that the information was not available, and all we had to do was find greater means to expose it and make it more available, that would be one thing. But the exposure of the information changes it. And I think that that's the manifesting of that is kind of what's producing fueling some of these paradoxes that Tsoukas raises.
I really like his subtitle for that part. It's one of those, the paradoxes that Tom introduced, the more information, less understanding. And I really like it because it makes one reflect on things. And first of all, we would probably all agree that having more light shed on more information is a good thing, right? It's something desirable to have more access to the sources, to what's going on, to kind of the openness and transparency of what's happening. But at the same time, what he highlights, and by means of Goffman, is that where you have more information that is not curated, it doesn't mean that there's more understanding. So widely available swaths of information and data sets that are just there do not automatically translate into a better understanding or more knowledge or more transparency. It's more confusing than anything. And he's going on Goffman to suggest that in such a setting, understanding of information is self-referential. So essentially, echoing back to our episode on stratified systems theory, individuals would understand what they're seeing based on their internal mental schemas. And that is something that not immediately pops into mind when you think about what is kind of desirable in terms of opening up information and more sources of knowledge and so on and so forth.
So Tsoukas is kind of drawing on articles from the popular press to fuel the narrative and the argument. And they're really nice empirical examples. There was this suggestion floated that there should be cameras in operating theatres, because these video cameras would help to keep surgeons to account. So if there's a malpractice occurs or something, they can go back and look at the video footage and then really see what actually happened and investigate the decisions that were made in the operating theatre. And Tsoukas points out that that is just such a betrayal of that setting of practice and expertise of the surgery, and that you're collapsing contexts so that the information which is recorded by the video camera and is intended for an audience of an auditor, for example, or for the public or for patients, that doesn't translate to that audience, because what the surgeons are doing in that space is very practice specific. So if they're listening to loud rock music or swearing or doing whatever it is that they need to do to cope with a very demanding job, that's not going to translate well to an auditing audience, but it's an inherent part of the practice. So just by installing that video camera and making this context, which you could think of in Goffman's language as a backstage, making that context into a front stage for another audience can actually really interfere with a practice that's been around for a long time. And I think it's those sort of complexities that become very, very important today as well, as we're thinking about introducing information technologies into all sorts of different work practices.
Right, because there needs to be some kind of a trust embedded within the system of communication and of information, that there needs to be a curation that would, as you said, contextualize and also grant insight into what the information represents. That somehow this notion that information is self-explanatory is far more prevalent than perhaps we'd like. The trick, I think, that we see now quite a lot of, and I think that what Harry is kind of hinting at in this paper is that, so it seems that transparency supersedes trust on account of new theories of information availability. So that as long as you have transparency and widely available information and codification of things, you no longer need trust, because what's the point, right? You can just go and check.
Exactly, it's inspectable. And I don't know about you, but that made me think of blockchain.
Yeah, exactly. Same here.
Yeah?
Completely.
Yeah. It's the same sort of ideal that if we can only make our transactions inspectable for all time, you can't tamper with them, so we have a record, and that is information that everyone has equal access to, requires no interpretation, then it totally annihilates the need for trust.
Yeah, we have a different word for it in the military. I don't know if it's exactly the same thing. We call it the 10,000-mile screwdriver. You're in a remote location from the big headquarters, in which the headquarters is interested in trying to keep track of the readiness of all of the units. And so we went through a phase about 15, 20, around the time actually that this article was published, in which we were looking at ways of trying to collect information automatically about the readiness, as opposed to having like manual entry systems in which we're reporting what's going on with our equipment, what's going on with people or whatever. And if you automated it, then that would make it easy for somebody at the big headquarters to figure out that something's going on. Of course, that the trust aspect becomes an issue, because what was felt down at the lower levels as these types of systems were being pursued is, okay, here are new and interesting ways in which we're about to be micromanaged. And it actually created challenges from a trust perspective. And it also didn't exactly increase understanding either, because just as Harriet indicates here, whenever you create an information system to collect information, you kind of assume, or a lot of assumptions about the information go into the database construction, the database engineering. And of course, in large, complex organizations, that the standard database entry doesn't necessarily match all of the context in which you want. So everybody starts bludgeoning their information in order to fit the database. And so then, you know, that kind of gets into a lot of what he's talking about, that the experiences are lost, and all you get at the headquarters level is somewhat of a stilted story that meaning has to be added back to. And of course, they're going to add different meaning than what was intended by the units on the ground. So that paradox, those two paradoxes really spoke to me in terms of, you know, how hard it is. If you're a large organization, how do you try to, or, you know, how do you make sense of the massive amount of disparate information that you're trying to process?
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a fundamental yet overlooked and perhaps neglected aspect of all this, that all this stuff that is quantified according to a particular protocol or a process. There are, as you said, assumptions that go into designing and collecting and processing what we receive as information. And they have an incredible impact on what it is that comes out of it. And his third paradox on more social engineering, more problems, kind of speaks directly to that. Even starting off with the most fundamental system of communication that we have, which is language. Language is full of assumptions and restrictions as well as enabling factors.
Yeah, and now another thing that that struck me in the area of trust too is he was specifically talking about the professions and professional, you know, expert knowledge in the professions. It also goes to that same vignette on the surgeons, because, you know, obviously it's one thing if the audience is an auditor, but when it comes to that expertise and the public. Now we think about the pressure that doctors face with patients who come in who have already self-diagnosed through some sort of a web-based medicine program. And they're basically looking for the doctor to, okay, can you prescribe me this particular medication? Or is this medication right for me? The ownership of the information or the expertise, who's really the expert then? How much does the public trust that the expert has the ability to apply expertise?
There's two sides to that, though, right? So the argument goes on the one hand that, you know, the quote unquote expert would have specialist domain knowledge and be sensitive to the context in order to discern some kind of knowledge out of the information that he or she is recipient of. And equally, on the other hand, you have a person highly sensitive to some form of context, but without the ability to discern necessarily insider knowledge from a lot of information. And so how do you balance it? It's not that one is 100% right and the other one is 100% wrong, because there are cases where doctors are very wrong. It's not an absolute domain of irrefutable knowledge. And on the other hand, there are patients that are hypochondriac. And so where do you draw the line? How do you assign the value that one group has or the other? And he alludes to this political economy of knowledge in this paper, not too much, but to an extent. And interestingly, and again, kind of echoing back to when we had our discussion on the Federalist Papers, remember when the Federalists were debating the Confederalists, one of the big things was emergence of factions. And so central government back then was perceived as a way to avoid emergence of factions. Well, Tsoukas here suggests that instantly available information actually facilitates factions and facilitates the empowerment of factions by obstructing public good. And this is super interesting. So basically what he's saying is that because of transparency, hyper-availability of information, the internet, you know, increased communication, and so on and so forth, it is actually increasingly difficult to defend and retain a domain of expertise. And expertise further translates into power or some kind of authority over information. And I think we see a lot of that, right? So manipulating context, introducing information not directly relevant, all that kind of stuff is extremely effective at undermining more established and traditionally accepted political economy of knowledge.
Let me ask a question. Do you see because Tsoukas refers specifically to special interests. Do you see that the same as factions? I wasn't sure.
I think so. I think it can be, because what is a special interest? It is a stake in the political economy of knowledge for a particular desired state of information or arrangement of information, right?
Yeah, I just when I was thinking about it, I wasn't sure if it was referring to like a special interest group in which you had a core that had a very specific interest, or when I think of faction, I think of a segment of the society who may be following a special interest. But it was just a question of the scope of this, you know, this body in which he is identifying as a minority view or a specific view that is going to dominate the information space.
I would imagine it's fairly fluent. So special interests arise out of factions and factions follow special interests. Something to that extent, probably.
Well, the I think the key at the end is this. It's the lead and follow that results from it, which I think was kind of an interesting way of putting things. That with these with the interests and with the increased information that that leaders or in this case elected leaders, this hyper democracy. Where the tables are kind of turned, where they're basically following the will of the masses, more or following the will of the masses to the point in which it's essentially the masses who are the leaders and the elected are followers.
But I think one of the cornerstones of this paper, what I alluded to in the beginning, is to do with the medium, because it's not the information or interests in on their own that manage to enact action, it's the use of a medium. So whether we're using one way of processing information or another, whether we're using one way of making it available and increasing transparency or another, it's basically to keep with the metaphor of the light, I think, it's to do with the light bulb. What color is it? Where is it pointing? How bright is it? That will all determine what falls into the light, what we'll see and how we'll interpret.
See, I definitely think the technology is super important. I feel like this is a more social constructionist sort of postmodern perspective in the sense of foregrounding that the kind of information that you get in these databases and then which people become known in terms of are all predicated on certain kinds of questions being asked. So the medium is super important, of course, but there's also the element of the social work and thought and assumptions that go into shaping even what is captured and what kinds of technologies we build to capture reality, and that that whole process has certain performative effects in the sense that they bring about then particular realities on the other side, which can really shape practice. So league tables are an example that Tsoukas is using here. And I think that that has a lot to do with this notion of social notions of competition, and then we set out criteria for what we decide are the important items that we need to gather information on, and that then leads to this artifact of the league table, which people can then end up managing that rather than managing people. They're managing league tables, and that was a very prophetic statement, I think, that was being made here, which has really permeated all sorts of different parts of practice. But I'm not sure where I see the medium fitting in so much in that message. To me, that's more about social processes and assumptions and about management as well.
Well, I worry if it's not the chicken or the egg kind of a thing. Because yeah. On the one hand, yes, you sort of you have the table and then you slot the data into it. But on the other hand, it's not really, doesn't work quite this way that we say, okay, so let's make a ranking of who is better. And then voila, you have a table that ranks that. It's more about what can we actually measure to put into there, what kind of information can, given the current state of our capabilities, be utilized in order to provide some kind of a nominal measurement of what we consider better. And that is a constraint.
Mm.
So if there was some kind of a Star Trekian way of synthesizing an artifact that would deliver a more or less unambiguous notion of in the case of tables, of what is better, maybe I would be more inclined to write it off to social convention. But the thing is that the technology and the environment, so kind of technology broadly speaking, so the physical environment of our social action determines the demands and needs that we will kind of inflict upon it. That makes sense.
I think that that really gets at this notion of reductionism that Tsoukas is mentioning, that we do have limited capacities to transport information across boundaries. So then we necessarily need to reduce what is recorded about a phenomenon, and then that becomes the stand-in for the phenomenon. Is that in lines with what you're saying around the constraints that we have?
I think it's more that, so action builds upon action. Every interaction that we speak of doesn't exist, or at least shouldn't exist if we're being intellectually honest. In a vacuum, it's not a first attempt at it, and doesn't start with a clean slate. So the physical environment, the previous decisions made, that is all determining what is going to happen next to a very strong extent. So I think where I'm going with this is that in a society where, or an organization, whatever, where something has been done a certain way before, there's not much reason to believe that whatever comes next is not just going to be an incremental improvement, at least in terms of principles.
I love how Tsoukas keeps talking about these temptations, because this is sort of what this new information society offers us. It's quite seductive in terms of what we can get tempted into believing. And the consequence of really believing that we can capture things about an environment such as a society or an organization, that if we just capture enough information, that we can then act on it and engineer it into something better is sort of a real temptation. And what he suggests a consequence of that might be is that we have oscillatory management. So that's where we're constantly trying to respond to the information that we're gathering to try and manipulate the environment to make it more effective, more efficient, and that you're just constantly interfering so that these cycles of gathering information, acting on that information to try and change it, and gathering information, that they can get out of control. And I think it's such an important point, and we can maybe explore it later, but it's something that reminded me of the way in which in some foyers today, like in certain organizations today, I've seen systems where you can tap to show management how you're feeling, how happy you are. So you kind of have a smiley face or a medium face or an angry face. And there are all of these ways in which employees can report how they're feeling. And I always think, where does that information go? The whole idea is to have a barometer of sentiment for the day, but I don't know what management's supposed to do with that. How are they going to then respond and improve the situation within the hour? So that's what I was thinking of when I heard of oscillatory management, which I think is a real problem that can come out of this whole temptation.
And that concludes part one. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Please join us next time here on Talking About Organizations.